IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a podcast on everything from employment to aircraft carriers.
We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Mumbai, Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs.
I'm Yazad, an economist.
And I'm Shambhavi, a cell biologist.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Many years back when I was a kid, I had read about David Vetter, Bubble Boy. David was born with an immune disease and he was very, very susceptible to any kind of bug. So he had to live in this plastic bubble and was so restricted. And I felt so sad about it, but I still remember Bubble Boy and, you know, feeling sad that he couldn't go out and play or do anything that, you know, I could do as a kid at that time. It seems today that children with that same kind of immune deficiency have a better hope than David Vetter did. David died when he was only 12 years old. But there are new technologies and new avenues for curing, or at least helping cure this disease. Shambhavi Nayak, who's going to join me, and Anirudh Ganesetti, tell us something more.
So you're right, and it was really difficult to see David Vetter growing up, right? If you see even pictures of him today, the fact that he could not hug his mother or that she could not sleep, put him to sleep and things like that, you know, the tiny things that we are so used to, he could not have. And that's because he had this disorder known as SCID, which is an immunodeficiency disorder. So basically, in our body, we have multiple lines of defense against bacteria or viruses that can cause disease. And the most specialized of these are B cells and T cells in the immune system. They will catch any bug that enters your body and kill it off. Because David's body did not have this one, had a mutant form of this one gene, these B cells and T cells were not formed in his body. And that rendered him susceptible to literally any form of disease. And the fact that he could not fight back that disease if the germ actually entered his body. So most infants who develop this disease die at a very young age. And hence they have to be kept in this really sterile environment where there is absolutely no way of a bug entering, which is very difficult to do. And as a child, I think it's very difficult to comprehend about why you're in this cage at all points of time. David spent a lot of his life in the hospital before he was moved to his parents' home, where again he had to be moved in a special transport. There was a bubble that was created in the parents' home for him to stay at, but he could never really go away from that. NASA actually made a spacesuit for him, which was still attached to the bubble, but he could at least move around the house a bit. But he found that also very painful, because to wear a spacesuit all day long is not something that is very comfortable. And he was very resistant to it at the beginning, but then he could actually go around the house, so he used it. But he unfortunately passed away before he could graduate to the next size of the suit that NASA made for him. The disease is a X-linked disease, so it basically comes from on the X chromosome. It is more likely to happen in male children, because they only have one X chromosome that comes from the mother. They get the Y chromosome from the father.
So there's less chance of a dominant gene balancing out that,
yes,
that mutation.
Yes. Whereas in daughters, because you can get a healthy copy, well, a normal copy of the gene from your father, you actually have a less predisposition. So David actually had a sister who was a carrier, but she herself did not suffer from the disease. There was a child before David who was a boy, but who passed away when he was 7 months old, I think, from the same SCID disease. So it is more frequently found in males than in females. And you're right, so recently studies have been done to use gene therapy to try and rectify the disease condition. Back in David's time, it was only bone marrow transplant that could be done.
From stem cells or cells from your siblings.
From your siblings. So you actually take the marrow out of your siblings and put them into you. The reason you use siblings is because if you use foreign cells, then your body could reject them because they are foreign to your body. So immune system could actually pick up that these are foreign and there could be a reaction, there could be inflammation and things like that.
Hang on, but I thought that if you have SCID, then your immune system doesn't work.
Not all. So some parts of the immune system doesn't, okay, don't work. But you can still, there is always a chance that your body will reject anything that comes out of, that is not self. So siblings is, you're just improving your chances of accepting the tissue because it's your sibling and most of your DNA would be similar. So David's sister Catherine did give her own marrow to David when he was 12. That's when the surgery happened. But unfortunately, and this was back in 1984, I think, and we did not have the means of screening marrow. We did not have the knowledge of all the different kinds of viruses that exist in nature or even in our body. And she actually was carrying an Epstein-Barr virus that did not get noticed when they were doing the surgery.
Oh no.
And she did not have any symptoms because she had a good immune system. But when they actually transferred that marrow into David, the virus attacked and he actually died out of complications because of that. So the scenario is pretty bleak. In 80% of cases, finding bone marrow transplant donors itself is difficult. So many children continue to live under these bubble conditions till the bone marrow transplants happen. So this gene therapy hopefully is a great new avenue for these kids.
So how exactly was this gene therapy administered? I heard that it is actually the virus that they use to inject the gene into the boy's cells is quite similar to the AIDS virus. So how exactly do viruses operate in that sense? How do they inject their DNA into cells?
So it was actually the HIV virus. So
It was the HIV virus.
So the way the virus is made is that a virus is basically a protein shell with DNA or RNA in it. Right? This basically is what or how most viruses are structured. And when viruses typically attack your cells, they will find a receptor on which they can bind and they only inject the DNA or RNA inside the cell. So the outside shell or the capsid remains outside. It doesn't go inside the infected cell.
Okay.
And then the DNA or RNA which goes inside hijacks the cellular machinery and makes more proteins, makes its own shell. And okay, then once the virus has made enough copies of its own DNA and proteins, it kills the cell and bursts out. So that's how viruses usually infect and duplicate.
So HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus. So yes, it specifically attacks the immune system.
Yes. So it attacks the T4 helper cells, okay, because it can pick a receptor on that. So if you remember the experiment in China, where He Zhuangke said that we couldn't...
The CRISPR-edited
virus. So what he was trying to do was remove that receptor from the babies, Lulu and Nana, because their father had HIV. And he was trying to prevent HIV susceptibility in the kids by removing the receptor. So the idea was that if you don't have the receptor, HIV can't bind to the cell and therefore you can't have the disease.
And the receptor is produced by a particular sort of genetic code within human cells.
Yes, it's a CCR5 gene. I don't think we have established what it does otherwise, but we know that it provides the receptor for HIV.
So you can theoretically and actually practically also just like mute that particular gene with no known consequences.
Yeah, yeah. So in this case, what the scientists did was actually use that known mechanism of action and just took out the HIV DNA. So that it doesn't actually cause HIV, but put in the gene that was mutated in the boys so that their cells could actually make that human DNA,
clever.
Which is required for the immune cells to be formed.
Right.
This kind of a therapy has been done before as well. In the 2000s, a similar form of gene therapy was performed, but again in 10 boys, but two of them developed leukemia over time. This is because when we do this kind of adding DNA from outside, the DNA goes and inserts itself somewhere in the human cell DNA. Whenever a gene has to be expressed, there's a regulator above it which has to be activated, right? The problem that these boys had was when the gene for making the immune cells was activated, the genes further down were also activated and started expressing more than they should have. And these were oncogenes. So these were cancer-causing genes. So these caused the immune cells to divide rapidly. And so the boys went from no immune cells to too many immune cells, and so developed leukemia, right?
Okay.
Which eventually led to issues there. So in the new therapy, what they have done is they have put in an insulator between the active, the gene that was required, the ILR2G gene, and the oncogene, so that the oncogene doesn't get activated accidentally. So these are the new tweaks that have been done.
How does the, and this is a bit of a noob question, but how does the gene know where in the DNA strand to insert itself? Why does it always target that particular area where the oncogenes are?
I don't think we know that. And it's not that it will always do that either.
Hmm.
There seems to be a site of preference where genes will go and get stuck.
Interesting.
So with CRISPR, what we do is CRISPR allows us the precision of putting in gene sequences where we want to.
Hmm.
With this kind of gene therapy, we don't have that much precision yet.
Okay, interesting.
So this is still in very early stages of development, this gene therapy for the bubble boys.
It is. So these, that 10 boys who have got the therapy in the last few years, all of them have been, so the last one was left hospital a few weeks ago.
Okay.
So it has been staggered, obviously, not at the same time. The longest trial period has been for 25 months. So they have been watching the child post-treatment for 25 months. And the child has gone home and has not shown any symptoms, either of SCID or of leukemia. But they're still waiting because leukemia could develop at any point of time. So it's too early to say on that front. But at least all the immune cells have been formed. So that is one good thing. It takes about 3 to 4 weeks to actually form. Sorry, it takes about 3 to 4 months to form all of the immune cells. So the child is treated in the hospital, is kept in the bubble till the immune cells are formed and then released. So we still have to wait and watch what happens. But this is exciting because if this kind of therapy works, then gene therapy would become more acceptable. There really is no other thing we can do for SCID children, but there are a number of other genetic diseases which are similar, for which we do not have treatments and which can be very debilitating for the child. And we could have a similar course of action being taken for those as well.
I was reading about Huntington's disease, for example. And this could also help in things like preventing Alzheimer's. So it has a much wider application than just SCID children.
Yes, it's quite. I mean, the second I read the article, I was like, this is revolutionary to have this sort of method where you're essentially using a virus that's capable of very quickly reproducing itself and essentially create the sort of self-reinforcing loop of correcting the genetic code of an individual. It's crazy.
Yes, I think every time Shambhavi comes on the show,
we
have some science fiction becoming science fact.
It is. I mean, it's quite awesome also because it was a learning track for scientists, right? We have, it's not like this has happened overnight. We have tried many things. This was not the first gene therapy also done for SCID children. There was something else that was tried earlier using a different kind of a virus and a different kind of a gene. But in that case, the therapy wasn't very effective. And the children required multiple injections to be given over time to ensure that the therapy had some kind of benefit. So obviously, we are moving to more efficient systems, which is what we would like. And we would like to learn on the way. Right?
So this current system is a once and done. So once the therapy has been given to the child, you don't have to go again for any kind of repeat booster dose or anything of that sort.
I think the child's descendants would also not have that problem because the genetic code has been corrected. Perks of germline gene editing, huh?
So that's what I think the argument is right, because now you at least have to wait for the child to be born and then you're doing this. With germline gene editing, you can fix it in the embryo itself. And then the child doesn't have to worry at all. So for David, for example, he had to be whisked away 20 seconds after he was born and put into a bubble.
So they knew that he was going to be born with this disorder.
Yeah, because he had a brother who had the same disorder. Yeah. They had obviously screened the parents and they knew that this could happen.
So this was possible. David was born in September 1971. So this this testing of this SCID was prevalent even at that time.
Yeah.
So it's something we've been battling for almost a half a century, and we finally managed to
Yeah.
It's honestly quite inspiring if you think about it. The, despite all the lies that have had to be lost along the way, it's good to know that we've overcome this.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this stems down to the opportunities that were given to scientists and physicians to be able to develop this, right?
Hmm.
A lot of our current thoughts about germline gene editing, for example, are extremely opposite to that.
Hmm.
People are calling for moratorium and ban. And so it won't allow this kind of research, this kind of open-mindedness. Obviously, we shouldn't be putting people's lives at risk.
Hmm.
But we also have to be cognizant that when it comes to children like those who suffer from SCID, their lives are always at risk. And improving them is what matters the most.
Another thing I was thinking about was, you know, what we call the European royalty disease.
Hemophilia.
So is this kind of therapy also going to help in hemophiliacs?
It will. So hemophilia is interesting in many cases. And hemophilia is one of the reasons why recombinant DNA became famous, which was is a very surprising turn of events. So recombinant DNA was, we figured we could make DNA in the laboratory in the 1970s. And similar to all of the chaos and panic we see with gene editing now, there were similar issues raised back in the 1970s about whether we should go ahead with this, whether scientists should be allowed, whether we are getting God's power, and, you know, same
someone
arguments.
Someone wrote Jurassic Park and made a multi-million-dollar franchise out of it.
Yeah. Obviously, with gene mutations, we then had all of the Marvel. I mean, I think Marvel owes a lot to science. But so back then, we had the Acyloma conference, which was held to decide about whether the world should continue researching recombinant DNA. And the public view was one of suspicion, and it should have been. And concurrently then, America witnessed its first epidemic of HIV. It started with the gay people, but then they found a lot of the hemophiliacs.
Because of
blood transfusion. And it was so bad at one point of time that if you had a severe hemophilia condition, you had a 90% chance of getting HIV because you were so dependent on blood transfusions happening all the time. Comes in the recombinant DNA, because now you could actually make that protein, clotting factor 8, that helps your blood clot in the laboratory. And there's no chance that it is going to be infected with HIV. Back then, we did not even know what was the virus and what it was doing, but we at least knew that in the laboratory, it was not going to happen. We knew it was coming from infected individuals otherwise, right? And it took 2 years to make that protein, but that actually changed the public perception to recombinant DNA technology. And I hope that similar incidences like that, which are happening now with gene therapy, will make germline gene editing and gene editing itself much more acceptable to public. But yeah, there's so many diseases that we can
That's an excellent point, because when we came out with our discussion document on a governance framework for gene editing, and we had this round table where we brought in a bunch of stakeholders, there was a gentleman who headed an association of parents whose kids suffer from congenital disorders. And they were absolutely in favor of making this treatment more accessible. And I think that if you were to just ask a parent, would you rather let this doctor edit your child's DNA, or let them die because of this lethal disease that is coded into their DNA? They would say, yes, go for germline. All these magnificent ethical, philosophical arguments that you are dooming future generations because you don't have their consent, I think are just so disconnected from the ground reality of parents who have to watch their children die.
Yeah, but one has to be careful about that.
I agree, you have to be careful, but the whole, at least the way that the narrative around germline has been structured, I think simply has not taken its life-saving potential into consideration enough.
I find a lot of confusion in the argument, because I see a lot of people bring out risks which are clearly scientific risks, because the technology is still nascent. We still have to figure out what happens into an individual if we put it in. But those are all scientific risks. The ethical risks are more about consent, of whether we are allowed to make these changes or not. And these are things that cannot be changed by law, by regulation, or just by doing experiments, right? This is something that should not change at all. If you ethically believe that I should not germline gene edit my child, then you should never believe that. I mean,
you should never want to do that. Yeah. That's right.
But if you believe that I don't want to do it now because the science is premature, then yes, that makes kind of sense. And I think there's in the narrative, there's mixing of both of these arguments together, and we need a better dissection of that.
That's a very clear point, because you're right about that.
And if when it comes to ethics, then my ethics are different from yours. And then I don't think that a state, a regulator, should be given the choice of making that for me. You make the option available of germline gene editing, and let me choose.
True.
If you're saying that it's scientifically premature, yes, the regulator could come in and say that this is risky, we shouldn't be doing this. But if you're saying that you should not be doing this because I believe that it's not to be done, then I don't think that's correct.
Agreed.
On that very clear and concise point, thank you so much, Shambhavi. Thank you, Anirudh.
Thank you.
Thank you, Azit.
We'd love to hear what you think about this chat. Check us out on our Twitter handle at Takshashila Inst or on our Quora space, All Things Policy. For the latest analysis and research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, visit our website at takshashila.org.in and tune in for our next episode.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.